And we are burning down the house every Thursday at 8 o'clock Eastern Time. Brought to you by TechServe, your number one source for everything related to the Macintosh computer on West 23rd Street in Manhattan. Produced and engineered by E.J. Dukoski. E.J., I'm getting a feedback here from my phones. I think the gain's up a little too high. Thank you. Your weekly continuing conversation about the culture of architecture. Thank you, that's much better. In which we tear down, lay forth, and now it's dead.
Again.
And build up the elements, the attitudes, opinions, obsessions, fantasies, passions, and ideas that direct and inform the creation of our built environment. And I'm Curtis B. Wayne, your host. Here with us in the studio, returning, are...
I can't hear very well. I can't.
You can't hear either?
No.
Okay, hold on. You know, people who believe in astrology would say that this is a direct example of the fact that the planet Mercury is retrograde.
Good.
Okay, thank you so much. Which means it's, as you watch its path in the sky, it's backing up. And Mercury being the planet, the messenger of communications, and we are communicating, is fouling things up. So this is just a prime example. This is not the astrology hour, this is the design hour. But, see, there you go. Now, eventually, things do get taken care of. Joining us in studio, the historian and writer Oliver E. Allen, his wife, who is a writer and is the niece of a famous woman architect, Eleanor Raymond, of whom I had not known before you were last here, is sitting in with us. And as our guest interlocutor, representing the voice of the people, Vox Populi, Fred Allen, their son, who's the managing editor of leadership at Fords.com. Is that correct?
Right, and representing Vox Humbug as well.
Now, when you were last with us, we had intended to talk about your research and the whole history of the Lower West Side, which is a project, a topic that's very dear to you. And it's really interesting to me also, the whole Washington Market area, which in Manhattan was vital to the food supply to New Yorkers, which over the years has gone through many, many transformations, from being a dirty industrial commercial center with the meatpacking houses and with trains on the street level on 10th Avenue running over pedestrians, such to the extent that I read that they called it Death Avenue, and now it has become this very nice mixed-use neighborhood with the Standard Hotel and the repurposed High Line. If you could come closer to your microphone or move it closer to you, Oliver.
The thing that that I've learned to admire about the area now that we call Tribeca is that it is one of the very few areas in the city, as far as I know, that has undergone a complete transformation twice in its history, because it started as a very polite and successful residential community with lovely little two or three or four story brick houses built to the, according to the, you know, the federal style, which is really, it's a really the American version of Georgian English.
So starting in the early 1790s?
Yeah, that's right.
By the time of our Constitution.
That's right, and that's why they call it the federal style. And there aren't very many of them left, because the city expanded up through this area, and then buildings began to be taken over by commercial interests and manufacturing, and so people didn't want to live there anymore. And the people who had lived there's one area that was really the center of it, and you wouldn't know it from being there now, but it, when you come out of the Holland Tunnel into Manhattan, and you go, there's a big traffic circle
right
there, and then you drive around that. That was the polite center of Tribeca. There was a wonderful church there, St. John's Chapel, and that was the center, and it was one of those places where the residents around the area had a key to the park.
Oh, so that was St. John's Park.
That's right. It was St. John's Park. That's right.
And totally obliterated now.
And it's totally obliterated now. And that whole residential community was wiped out with the onrush of commerce, which then almost all of those old buildings were torn down. We have one little patch of them on Harrison Street, and there's a couple of others, but they're pretty much all gone. And the whole area was rebuilt with these wonderful 19th century commercial buildings, which have resulted in the this area being, in effect, a museum of 19th century commercial architecture.
Now, for people, I'm sorry, I just want to set the scene a little bit for people. From Manhattan, to help them find this on the map.
Yeah.
So it's generally below 14th Street. Well, the Washington Market extended about as far as 14th Street.
Right.
Tribeca is a triangle of land below Canal.
Yeah.
So we're talking about the whole stretch of the west side from 14th Street, which is the northern boundary of traditionally of Greenwich Village. Almost all the way down into the financial district.
Well, that's true, except that Tribeca, which is the area that I really focus on, is really below Canal, not the West Village. The West Village is another whole story.
But wasn't that part and parcel of the same usage of commercial activity?
Yes, except that the West Village never really became that commercial. It was always residential and still is.
Except, well,
yeah,
well,
I think we're really talking about a couple of neighborhoods a couple of miles apart. When you said the Lower West Side, but when you were first describing it with 10th Avenue and the Standard Hotel, you really meant the Meatpacking District up just below 14th Street.
Yeah, I meant Washington Market.
And then, but the and of course, there was the Jefferson Market in Greenwich Village, but the Washington Market was where you are, right? In Tribeca, around Duane Park, and that's a couple of miles south of there. They're very distinct neighborhoods with a lot in between them.
Yeah. So that, well, at any rate, the whole Tribeca area became, first of all, it was became the food depot of New York City, in which all the food that came to the restaurants and the grocery stores and the markets in all over Manhattan came through this area. So
and
there was the food. Was the food thing. There was also the textile.
And in which years are we talking now?
What?
When the food came in through that area.
We're talking about starting in the 1850s and 60s when these big commercial buildings were built, totally wiping out those residential structures. Then it became the food depot because there was originally a retail and wholesale market down about where the World Trade Center is that was called the Washington Market.
Mm-hmm.
But that the with the growth of the city, the amount of food handled couldn't be done in that building. So wholesale food importers began moving uptown, up Washington Street, and it became known as the Washington Market, not because it was so much, it was an outgrowth of the actual Washington Market, but it was along Washington Street.
So that was a structure, I'm guessing, I haven't actually seen it, but like Paris's Les Halles.
Yes, exactly.
Which also has been torn down.
That's right, yes, right. So that became a hugely successful operation that lasted for almost 100 years until the 1950s when
other things took place that made it all very complicated and difficult and expensive to import food that way. So that then it was done another way. And the textile business started in the 1840s and 50s and 60s with which is a whole other separate story, but
we have,
but
back we in have the, plenty of time.
But back in
well, that
the,
explains
back,
why there's these buildings with their pediment saying the cotton exchange, the wool change, yeah. the silk building,
yes,
which are now all converted to housing.
Sure.
So but these were the, actually exchanges?
Well, there was the mercantile exchange. There's a building now at Hudson Street and Harrison Street that's. Was the mercantile exchange, and in the old up until the 1970s, when it finally moved out to bigger quarters in World Trade Center, and then they moved. Now they're way over by the river. In the summertime, if you wandered past that building. And the windows were open because nobody had any air conditioning. You could hear the people bidding. There was a lot of shouting going on.
Auctions are always full of shouting.
That's right. That's what was going on.
If you've ever been on the floor of the New York Stock Exchange, you know, there's a lot of shouting.
There's
happening.
An awful lot of shouting, and of course, this isn't working that way so much in the New York Stock Exchange anymore because it's mostly done by computer. But you get it in the Mercantile Exchange, which is still. Operated that way,
sure,
so when
or,
you
see, or
you
the, can or see that Chicago on Chicago Board of Trade,
exactly.
In the pit.
People are all wearing different colored jackets, denoting who they are and so forth. Well, that was all going on there, full scale, for 100 years, and then it kind of because this all was used to be fed by the railroads.
Right.
And then the railroads gave way to trucking because the trucking was cheaper, and it could get stuff into the city, but the trouble more easily than the railroads, and other economic things, took place so that the food depot kind of choked itself to death, and they began moving those operations out. So we were left with these fantastic commercial warehouse buildings. One of which my wife and I live in,
mm-hmm.
and they turned out to be exactly what people would like to live in. So at this point in the 1950s and 60s, the neighborhood began to change back to being totally residential, which is the way it is now. Yeah.
You know, economic cycles are fascinating in this way because of the Third Avenue elevated train to Third Avenue L. Mm. Third Avenue was not nearly as completely rebuilt and renovated after World War II as were some of the other avenues.
Oh, I think it was.
Well,
oh, sure.
But on Third Avenue, we have a splendid collection of Irish bars, which back to the time when the properties that were adjacent to the L. Were not very valuable, and I think that's
I remember a wonderful seafood place on around 58th Street and 3rd Avenue right under the L. Wonderful restaurant. But that's all gone now because
The L
went away and suddenly the real estate values escalated and those old buildings were torn down. The thing that saved Tribeca was historic preservation, which took place in the 1960s and 70s. And the Landmarks Commission became interested in this area and said, we have to save this. And as a result, the thing is, the area now is fabulously successful, I think to a large extent because people move in and they know that their buildings are not going to be torn down. They're going to stay there. And
the view is not going to be ruined.
The view is not going to be ruined. There'll still be plenty of sunlight, and it made a tremendous difference.
But one thing, beautiful apartments are not going to stay there because every time somebody buys a condominium and moves into it, they tear everything out, all the marble and all the mahogany and all the beautiful bathrooms and kitchens and media rooms and so on, and start fresh. New floor, first of all, new floor, new plan.
Yeah, well, that's just the nature of having too much money.
They do it even before they move out. Before you move out, you have to completely redo your five-year-old kitchen to sell it to somebody new, and then the new person comes in and rips out that brand new kitchen.
That's right.
One surprising thing about the history of the Lower West Side, when you describe these food markets that were moving out by the 1950s and how long before that the railroads were replaced by trucking, is that the High Line, which has just become the beautiful High Line Park, what you wouldn't guess from what we've said so far about the history was that that was built in, what, the early 1930s?
Yes, in the 1930s.
It was a very recent railroad
line. It's a very recent. Yeah. It was one of the most recent.
Let's not get into railroads yet. I'd like to take a brief... No, I'd like to... I want to talk about railroads and the High Line, leading up to the High Line. Let's take a brief musical break. Let's hear some Billy Joel in a New York state of mind. State of mind here as we are continuing with our conversation about Lower West Side. This is Burning Down the House on HeritageRadioNetwork.com, brought to you by TechServe, the number one source for everything related to the Macintosh computer in Manhattan. Not where we are right now. We're in Brooklyn, in beautiful East Williamsburg Industrial Park, actually. Sitting in the garden of Roberta's restaurant into repurposed shipping containers. And all of you who are listening, if you're in the New York area, come on over. More is merrier. The house rules here for this program are those which pertain in an architect's studio, drop in, say hello. We like chaos. We can manage that. I have a master's of chaos management from the School of Life. And but we were about to start talking about rail, especially in the West Side, in Manhattan. We don't think about locomotives being on our streets, and yet the elevated rails, when they started out, were coal-burning or wood-burning locomotives, spewing cinders all over the place. And
little tiny locomotives, no size at all. They're only about 7 or 8 feet long.
Really?
Only about 5 feet high.
Like Tom Thumb.
That's right, exactly. Like if you've ever been to Mount Washington and seen the cog railway engines that go up Mount Washington, they were very much like that. They were little, they probably made a lot of smoke, but they weren't very big.
But they were powerful, and they could pull a whole train of cars.
That's right.
From station to station.
Yeah.
But so at one point, because there are no, before the tunnels under the river, mm-hmm. which I guess are a 20th century phenomenon.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
How did goods, food, cattle, how did they get into, did they come across on barges from New Jersey?
Yes. The railheads were all in New Jersey. Some of them are still there.
If you look across from Battery Park, you see this really big freight terminal
Jersey
City.
Oh, that's beautiful. The Central Railroad of New Jersey terminal, it's a French chateau. It's across the Hudson from the Battery. It's a lovely building.
And it's part of Liberty's National Park now.
That's right. And that was a rail terminal for commuters who would come in, and then they'd get onto a ferry and take them down to Lower Manhattan. But as far as food and other things are concerned...
So freight did not come out of there?
No, I don't think so. But freight would come to freight terminals, and the Jersey Shore was filled with these marshalling yards and for railroad cars, and the food would come in on box cars, and the box cars would be transferred to flatboats, lighters or whatever you call them.
Barges.
Well, they're not really barges. They're really little. There would be a flat boat that could carry about six flat cars, and they would be pushed by tugboat across the river to the piers along the shore.
And there are a few of those that have been preserved as part of the Hudson River Parkway there.
Very, very few. The single piers don't really exist anywhere. You have things like the Chelsea Market thing, which is an outgrowth of the piers that were there.
Uh-huh.
You have a few piers in Tribeca that have been, a couple of piers are being rebuilt, but the old piers were deteriorating, and because they were all made, if they'd been made of concrete and steel, that would have been fine, but they were made of wood.
Because it was
cheaper to make them out of wood, and the other advantage of wood is that it's flexible. So if a boat hit the side of a pier, the pier would give.
Yeah.
The boat would not be destroyed.
Well, there is at least one of these articulated rises and falls with the tide piers with rails on them. That's the connector between the shore and the floating barge that has the frying pan restaurant and also the light ship down not far from your house, Fred, in the West Village, and which you can see. It's an amazing sort of thing, and those ruined piers far up in the 40s that burned had articulated
and the ones in
pierheads
by Trump City, the West
exactly.
West 60s. You can see that, and I think that don't they still have a wonderful crumbling iron thing?
It's the one that burned, and they kept the armature.
Yeah, right. Well, the whole pier situation was wonderful because we would have
And so,
there would be pier fires. These things were all made out of wood. They were all very ramshackle, and they would catch fire. And this is why we had the fire boats.
I never realized.
Sure, because there was a pier fire every few months, another pier would burn, and you had to put it out. But what happened was that the whole economics of that began to fall apart. One thing, the railroads were, starting in the 1930s, the railroads were making much less money, and they couldn't afford to sort of give things away. They used to float those barges across to Manhattan and pay for it themselves because it was worth it. And they were getting a lot of freight that way. And sometime in the 1950s, apparently the railroads said, hey, we're going to have to charge for this. And the merchants in Manhattan who were importing food said, we can't pay for that. We were paying too much already. And the whole mechanism began to fall apart.
But if we step back in time a little bit, when all of our food, and this will be of interest to people who listen to some of the other programs on this network, mm-hmm. which are about food production, how we get our food, mm-hmm. The whole slow food movement is very mm-hmm. important to mm-hmm. the group that's involved with Heritage Radio Network. Mm-hmm. So they'd come across and they'd roll onto rails in Manhattan. And
they would stay. The flat cars stayed on the boats, but the food was unloaded from those box cars on those flat boats onto the piers.
So where does the railroad that was on 10th Avenue come into the picture?
That's a whole different system.
What was that? Now, what was
that
for?
Mainly not for food. That was a lot of other stuff.
Building materials?
There were two original rail lines that were built to serve Manhattan. And one was on the east side.
And New York Central.
With New York Central. And the other one was the Hudson River Railroad, which came down across from... It crossed over into Manhattan at the very top of Manhattan.
At Spuyt and Duyvil, which is now part of the Amtrak system.
Right. And
Metro North, yes.
Right. And the line came all the way down, and... This is where you get the 10th Avenue thing. The trains ran on the street, and it was very dangerous.
No grade crossings.
No
just
grade
right crossings. Down the street.
That's right. But interestingly enough, they knew that this was dangerous, so they always in front of the engine, there would be a man on a horseback.
A cowboy or something.
A cowboy. He's like a cowboy, and he would guide the train down, and he would say, "Get out of the way! Here comes the train," and this. This rail line originally came all the way down the west side, down West Street, and then it came inland at Canal Street and went down Hudson Street. And originally...
Wow.
And ended at Chambers Street. There was a passenger terminal there at Chambers Street and Hudson Street, which was one of the first... railroad terminal buildings in the city. This was back in the 1850s and 60s.
Well before Grand Central.
That's right. Well, Grand Central was built by Commodore Vanderbilt, who acquired both of these rail lines and combined them into the New York Central Railroad. He took over the Hudson River Railroad and also took over the east one, the one that started at Union Square, and then went up all the way up Park Avenue.
Before it was just Fourth Avenue.
That's right, it was Fourth Avenue. Up there, and it was on the surface, and it was very dirty and everything. And then finally, Vanderbilt said, "We can't have this," so he abolished the rail line below 42nd Street and put his big terminal building there. The first of three. The one we see that we know now is the third one on the site.
Uh-huh.
And I'm very proud to tell people that the architect of the first of the three buildings was an architect named John B. Snook, who designed several buildings in Tribeca, and he was a wonderful architect. He could build anything. He built factories, he built houses, and he built the railroad terminal.
We architects like to think that we could build anything. It's the opportunity to build anything.
That's right. But a lot of architects, I think, they kind of tend to stick with one style. But Snook will do anything.
Well, it's a competitive advantage being an expert in,
that's true.
Healthcare or high-rise condo towers or... not too many factories being built these days.
No.
So,
in China there are.
Yeah, in China. Yes.
In China, they are building factories.
Yeah.
But to bring it all together, Commodore Vanderbilt began operating one of those ferries on the Hudson.
That's how he started.
He started as a ferryman.
A ferry from Staten Island. He was a Staten Island boy, and his ferry was from Staten Island to Manhattan. And he made his money because when the weather was terrible, other guys would say, no, we're not going out in that weather. And Vanderbilt said, get on board, I'll deliver you. And he did. And that was the kind of guy he was.
Were these steam ferries?
No. They were rowed, I think. I think they
Yikes.
Were or sailed.
Uh-huh.
Oh, yeah, they were, there was not. No, they didn't have steam ferries.
This would have been the 1830s or
something? Oh, yeah, that's right. Yeah, before he even got into the Hudson River paddle wheel.
Side wheel, Fulton style
that's
ferries.
That's right, yeah, before that.
Did he compete with Fulton?
No, well, nobody competed with Fulton. Fulton didn't live very long. You know, Fulton, so-called, there's a big argument about who invented the steamboat, and Fulton probably copied of other people's design, but he was smart, and he organized it better. He could sell the idea better, and he was, you know, he built the one who built the boat, the Claremont that went all the way up.
Yeah, he was also politically connected to the Livingstons.
Absolutely.
The old Dutch
That's
patroon
right.
family.
If you knew the Livingstons, you could get anything done.
That's right. His wife was a Livingston, and there was a Livingston who signed the Declaration
of
Independence.
Well, he made it stick. He made it take. As other Europeans may have come to North America before Christopher Columbus, it doesn't really matter because it made no difference.
That's
Columbus
right. And the other,
really
the great competitor.
Made it happen.
The great competitor of Fulton's principal competitor was John Stevens, after whom the Stevens Institute of Technology is named. And Stevens probably had a steamboat before Fulton did, but he was not the promoter.
I see. Yeah. So did Fulton actually operate the Fulton Street Ferry?
No,
or was that a franchise?
I think that the street was named for Fulton.
After he
and
died.
But you know, Fulton died around 1815.
Yeah.
He died at the age of 40-something.
I didn't know that.
Yeah. So
I didn't know that he was a portrait painter before he became an inventor.
Well, those were the days when you could do many things, like Samuel F.B. Morse.
Who was a portrait
painter before he invented the telephone.
Well, Fulton was on the make all his life.
He came from a very poor farming family.
Oh, the telegraph.
Fulton came from a very poor farming family, and first he decided he was going to be a successful portrait painter, and he went to England to learn to do it, and he couldn't do it at all. And after a few years, he gave that up, and canals were big, and he decided he was going to be the great canal builder, and then that didn't work, and he gave that up. And then he decided to invent the submarine and submarine warfare, and first he tried to sell it to the English to use against the French, and then after a while, when that didn't work, he went to France and tried to sell it to the French to use against the English.
And I think he got a contract for
that. It was one fiasco after another, but then he met the new ambassador to France named Livingston at a party in Paris, and Livingston said, I have this problem. I have a contract. I've been granted a monopoly on steam ferry service on the Hudson, but nobody can build a steam ferry. And Fulton said, oh, I'll do it. And this time he actually did.
So, let's take a little break with a little New York native music from George Gershwin and then get back to the High Line.
Yeah. Thank you.
Was nice. Fred's a musician. Well, he was a music major at Harvard, an affiliation that we sort of share, but we don't. Fred was chasing around, I don't know, being a member of Pork or something, and I was at the design school at about the same time. We were talking during the break about Gershwin and his reputation. And, of course, you know, he's a native New Yorker from Harlem, back when Harlem was the posh place to live.
That's right, yeah. Hard to realize now, but those buildings are very solid.
It's beginning again.
Yeah.
Oh, economics plays a role in creating living museums of fabulous architecture that isn't torn down because there's no imperative to put up something higher, taller, fancier. And that's why we have all these beautiful, beautiful buildings.
Well, it's what somebody said that Tribeca benefited from benign neglect. I mean, nobody paid any attention to these buildings,
and they're so well built that you could not maintain them for decades, and they didn't fall down.
You didn't have to do anything. Yeah, they're just so strong, so beautifully made, and so lovely. Because the wonderful thing was that some of the best architects in the city were designing warehouses in Tribeca. I like to. There's a building on.
I'm sure, people like Church, like George Post. Didn't George Post design the Singer Building?
Yeah, but George Post wasn't involved in Tribeca. But I'll tell you who was. There's a building on Church Street and Leonard Street. And it's called the Textile Building. Nice, simple title.
Sure.
That was designed by Henry Hardenberg, who designed the Plaza Hotel
and the Dakota
and the Copley Plaza in Boston and the Willard Hotel in Washington. Everybody knows about Henry Hardenberg.
Well, I thought he also did the Dakota.
And the Dakota, yeah. Yes, that's right.
I mean, if you look at the Dakota, it's a yellow version of the Plaza Hotel.
And we have a wonderful building up on Hudson Street and Franklin Street that was designed by Carrere and Hastings, who did the New York Public Library building.
Uh-huh.
So the thing was that these merchants were ambitious people. They cared about their reputation, and they wanted to have good buildings that were good advertisements for themselves. So they hired these damn good architects.
Especially Frank Woolworth. But speaking
yeah, with Cass Gilbert.
Speaking of, yeah, of Harlem, part of the history of the whole West Side is the history of the central black neighborhood of New York moving, and the sort of black slum, which was downtown, was in Greenwich Village, moved up to Hell's Kitchen. The reason West Side Story is set where Lincoln Center is now is because that a lot of the black slum had moved up there until finally Harlem began to be built up as a luxury development and nobody moved in, and then that became
the owners reduced their prices and the blacks could afford it. And we were being pushed out of the West 50s and 60s too.
Yeah.
At the same time.
So this is in the post World War II period.
No, this is back 100 years ago.
This is back well, Harlem was still polite into the 1920s.
Polite?
I'm pretty sure. Yeah, it was good. It was a very polite area. Sure, and then...
It's polite, again. I travel frequently through 125th Street. And
as in polite society.
Yes, that's what I see. I mean, the social register type people.
That's right. That's what I meant by polite, yes. So, no, I didn't. I don't.
He didn't mean mannerly.
No. Yeah.
Even today, they give you a seat on the subway.
Right.
No, New York is a vastly improved place, and...
It is, but you know, it's
over
it's,
30, it's, even it's, 20 years ago.
We can marvel at the architectural history and the development and so forth of Manhattan, but the problem is that Manhattan is now becoming a middle and upper class place. There is no lower. Nobody can afford to live there unless they have a fair amount of money anywhere in Manhattan, maybe at the very northern tip.
Inwood Park.
Inwood, yeah, in that area.
Fort Washington.
Could be, yeah. That's not terribly expensive, but the rest of it, it's, you know, people...
But that's such a long commute from Midtown.
That's right.
That you could be in Maspeth, Queens, and take the LIRR and have a shorter commute.
Sure. But the people who might be moving there now are moving here to East Brooklyn.
And that's part of the genius or the vitality of this whole scene.
That's right.
Is people moving into formerly industrial areas.
That's right, and they make them over, and they move into factory buildings and stuff. And as we were told when we moved into Tribeca, we said people told us.
Which was in 1982. It's a while
ago. 1982. It's pretty fairly recent. But we were told if you look, go around at nighttime, and if you see, look up at the buildings. And if you see plants in the windows, that means they've been settled by probably artists who loved the area because there were big spaces, big rooms.
Oh, absolutely.
You're doing abstract expressions with your 12-foot high canvas, you could do it.
In 1983, I looked at a loft apartment in that beautiful red brick building that's just north of Duane Triangle.
Mm-hmm.
It was the second floor south apartment.
Mm-hmm.
And my...
Is it not 55 Hudson Street? Maybe...
I don't remember the address.
Oh, okay. Yeah, you mean the one right facing the park?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, with the terracotta trim.
Oh.
And
that one.
My wife and I have, at the time really loved the apartment, but we couldn't afford it.
Yeah.
Because it was $125,000.
Yeah.
And we could only afford about $115.
Yeah. That was that did it. Yes.
Yeah. I think that last changed hands for about $5 million.
When we moved into Tribeca in 1982, we thought we were moving into a frontier.
Well, it was,
and it was at that point.
There weren't any stores,
but it was just beginning to arrive.
Yeah, now it's totally
civilized. Somebody, I heard that our zip code 10013 was the fourth wealthiest zip code in the United States. How do you like that? For a frontier...
Can I ask you for a loan?
What I want to know is, who the hell are 1, 2, and 3? I figure Beverly Hills. Maybe 10128. You know, the upper 80s and stuff. Yeah, the east side.
Yeah.
Probably. And then... What else?
Hey, I don't know. EJ, why don't you Google that?
I recently saw, I think...
Top zip codes. You've got a mic in there now. You can talk to us.
I think one is around Palo Alto. One or two are in California, and one I think might be in the Palo Alto area.
Because of the Silicon Valley?
Yeah.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah.
Right.
The other two,
The thing that makes it wealthy... It's per capita residences. You see, so obviously
there are not too many people. And one of your neighbors is Robert De Niro.
Oh,
so that just skews everything.
That's right. But you have fabulously wealthy districts in New York that don't count as wealthy districts because nobody lives there. It's only office buildings. If you take
Rockefeller Center,
East 42nd Street, that's obviously the values there are terrific. By the way, do you know the story of John Jacob Astor, who won when he was still...
He was a hat maker. He was in the beaver trade.
He's in the beaver trade. His brother was a hat maker, I think. But he was in the beaver trade, and he would go and ride around through the wilderness and buy beaver pelts and bring them in, and he was very smart. But while he was still doing that, he began to buy property in Manhattan, because he said, I know that this is going to be an important place. This is going to grow. It's a good investment. And there was one day he heard...
1830s, 1820s?
1810, in there, way back.
Wow.
Way back. And there was one time he heard about a farmer who lived uptown who had taken a mortgage on his property and couldn't pay for it and was about to be foreclosed. And Astor heard about this and got on his horse and rode up to see the man, and he said, you don't want to let the bank take over. Let me take over. I'll give you the money for it, and and you'll be okay. And so the man said yes. And so Astor acquired this property. I mean, the man then couldn't even make the payments to Astor. So Astor took it over. And this man's farm was roughly from Times Square to the river in the West 40s. And that was one farm. And think of the value of that now.
Did he let the farmer live on the property for a while?
He was very nice to him, sure, but he owned it.
Keep farming it.
And he could keep it, sure. Astor never really developed things. He would wait for other people to buy him, and then he'd make a deal.
I see.
Sure.
So subdivide.
He was not a builder. He was a
speculator.
He was a trader. Yeah, a speculator.
Huh.
And he was very perceptive.
Did he own the property where the Waldorf Astoria was, which is now
not,
where the Empire State Building was?
No. I don't think one of his heirs. The story that I like to tell.
Descendants.
That what I like to say is that we all admire the Western Union, Empire State Building. Everybody loves it. They say, what a great building. Isn't that fantastic? Well,
yeah.
If we'd had landmarks, if we'd had a landmark law, the Empire State Building could not have been built. Because it was
course.
On the side of the Waldorf Astoria Hotel.
Yes, exactly. Well,
right. And so the Waldorf
Astoria. The Waldorf and the Astoria.
And,
with Peacock Alley down in between them, running
east
and west.
And those buildings, of course, were beloved by everybody that ever went in there. But those buildings, if we'd had landmarks law, could not have been built because they were built on the side of Mrs. Astor's house. She gave a party and they only invited 400 people.
That's right. Because the ballroom could only fit 400 people.
That's right. So when people talk about landmarks being the savior of the city, I say, now wait a minute. One of the reasons New York is the way it was is that we did not have landmarks for such a long time.
That's
so
right.
You could have all this incredible development.
Right. And the last Dutch building, for example, on Ann Street downtown.
Oh. I don't think there are any, are there?
It's gone.
They were.
It was replaced
gone.
By...
There's only one or two Dutch buildings left in the city, and that's the Peter Wyckoff House, way over out in Brooklyn.
Also uptown, there's the...
You notice it when buildings are very old. There are so few of them. For instance, speaking of Astor, I know there are a couple of buildings on West 14th Street between 7th and 8th Avenues near 8th Avenue. One of them has a little liquor store in it. And you notice them because they're two stories high. They're not even three stories. They're so old. And those buildings belong to John Jacob Astor, and there they still are.
Did they?
Yeah. It happens. If a building's that old, which block? So we can all have a look. It's likely to happen if a building's that old because he owns so much. It's on the south side of 14th Street between 7th and 8th Avenue, close to 8th Avenue. There's a liquor store between where Nell's was, which is now gone, and the corner of 8th Avenue, just a few doors down. And you'll see
a
couple of two-story buildings. Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, you could pitch hit for Christopher Gray when he's not available to write for the Times, Fred. You know that? No, that's really great.
I'd run out of material too fast.
No, that's fabulous. Do we want to talk about the High Line at all? I mean,
well, it's almost a separate subject. I mean, how?
But it is rail. How it is rail.
It is rail.
Yeah,
it is rail, and that's the rail line that I was talking about that came down all the way down to Hudson Street.
Correct.
The first thing that happened was that Vanderbilt, in 1868 or 9, Vanderbilt, having just taken over the New York Central Railroad and had big ideas about what to do, he bought St. John's Park, which had been the center of polite society.
Lock, stock, and barrel. He bought it from the city.
He bought it. Uh-huh. And the city said, nobody cares about that anymore. And he built a huge rail terminal there, so that whole area was filled with the clanking of railroad cars and steam engines and stuff.
The rail
line came down West Street and then came east on Canal Street and then down Hudson to that terminal, and that's the line that was replaced in the 1930s by the elevated thing. They couldn't run that. They were still in the 1920s. They were still running freight trains down West Street and down Canal Street with a horse and a rider in front of them saying, "Beware of the train, it's coming
crazy
here." Right. And
so the High Line was to take that rail traffic and
elevate it, right. Yeah. And in which they finally said, "This is the answer to all of our problems." In the 30s and built it, and it went down. The interesting thing was that it didn't go down an avenue; it went down in the middle of a block.
So not to destroy the property values on the avenues.
It was only in service for what, 30 or 40 years?
Yeah.
It didn't last very long.
From the middle 30s until finally the last train was sometime 70? In the 1960s.
According to the Friends of the High Line, the last was 8. Boxcars with frozen turkeys in 1980, which is hard to believe, isn't it?
Yeah.
I don't know where they were going or where they were coming from, but
and then for a long time,
that's the history.
A long time, there were all sorts of plans. There was a guy who was convinced that it should be developed as a high speed rail line to serve the west side of Manhattan.
High Line?
Yeah, sure.
It's a high speed?
Oh, sure.
It's got turns in it.
Well, not very many. Not very many. Well, I mean, high speed for the city means 40 miles an hour. You can do that.
Oh, we're not talking about a streamliner like Burlington Zephyr.
No, or the Acela.
The Acela is slower than the Burlington Zephyr of 1936.
No. That's right. But
it is. Burlington Zephyr hit 119 in Kansas on a straightaway.
Well, of course,
the Acela does something like that.
Between
New York and Washington, not between
somewhere
New York and Boston.
Somewhere between
it. Yeah. The right of way isn't straightened up between New York and Boston. That's why it takes so much longer, relatively.
Yeah, it slows down
to
about 50 miles an hour.
Somebody told me that the rail line a railroad train going from Boston to New York in effect, if you add up all the curves, it turns, the railroad train turns around 28 times.
Yeah, they built the Long Island Railroad in the 1840s because they were convinced nobody could ever finish a right-of-way, to get a right-of-way between New York and Boston. So they figured they'd just send a train down Long Island
and then have, put you on a
and
boat.
And then put you on a boat.
Uh-huh.
And it made sense for about 5 years, and then the right-of-way was built, and then Long Island Railroad was obsolete, and it went right down the middle of the island. The only people who lived on the island lived on the shores, so it was an utterly useless, pointless railroad for a very long time after that.
Yeah.
And still, getting a ride on the LIRR to go out to the Hamptons is...
Well, it's a lot better than it was when was it Governor Rockefeller who called it the world's greatest railroad?
It was going to become the world's greatest railroad.
Yes.
Right, and then having
money
made that
at it.
Yes, yeah. But then having made that promise, he then a year later said it now was the world's greatest railroad.
Yeah. And it wasn't.
It hadn't really changed. It was
probably the world's greatest railroad is the TGV in France.
No, my wife
on
once
its way to,
remembers a train stopping and sitting a long time, and finally a conductor announcing that it was stopped because there were leaves on the tracks.
Well, that's a big problem in Italy, apparently, also in in England, also apparently in Long Island. You know, slippery. Ride on slippery tracks.
Yeah.
I think we've come to the end of our time. Thank you, Fred Allen, Oliver Allen, Deborah Allen. Been talking about all things Manhattan, West Side Rail, Gershwin. This is Burning Down the House, brought to you by TechServe. Thanks to E.J. Dukoski, engineer and producer this evening. Next week, we're going to talk about the U.S. Green Buildings Council, the LEED program, and a Brooklyn mechanical contractor, Henry Gifford, who is very much opposed to what he sees as bunkum. And it should be really quite interesting. Henry Gifford versus USGBC. I'm Curtis B. Wayne, your host. Talk to you next time.